at that point, though, my parents were saying, okay, well, what's the next step then? Like, do you want to be a coach? I didn't want anything to do with the running at all.
Welcome to the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast, where it's all about learning from the best minds in the sport so you can train smarter, stay healthy, and run faster now. And now your host, Tina Muir.
Hello, this is Tina Muir. Thank you so much for being here with me today for the latest episode of the Run to the Top podcast brought to you by Runners Connect. Hard to believe this, but this is my 50th podcast episode. I can't believe it's almost 2016, and many of us will be celebrating the holidays right now, which makes me even more thankful that you've taken the time to listen to this episode today. I'm not going to waste too much of your time here, so hopefully I'm going to make it worthwhile for you. Over the next 2 weeks, I have found two very inspiring guests for you, but both of them have found their balance in their lives, but coming at it from different angles. I'm sure between them, they're going to hit the whole spectrum of the runners listening, and it will actually allow all of us to kind of understand both ends. This week, I'm going to focus on an elite runner. Someone who was living every collegiate runner's dream, running at the University of Oregon. And not only was he running at the University of Oregon, but it was at the time of Matt Centrowitz, Galen Rupp, Andrew Wheating, and many other studs. And he, like many of us, thought he had life figured out. You know, he expected to be successful in the marathon, continue seeing running as his moneymaker, keep getting better and better. But in his first marathon, he struggled so much that he ended up quitting the sport, did not intend on ever running again, and had absolutely no interest in anything about running. So this story will really open your eyes and show you that life as an elite is not only what you expect, but sometimes even the fastest runners in the country can lose that passion for it. And there's nothing wrong with that. This interview really helps to show the importance of balance, and I'm sure you will leave this interview looking differently at your own training. All right, so that's enough of an intro from me. I want you to get back to your friends and family. So who is this elite? Okay, his name is Luke Puskedra. He ran at the University of Oregon, where he finished as high as third at the Cross Country Nationals, and he actually ran a 101.36 half marathon while in college. He has PRs of 13.31 in the 5K, 27.56 in the 10K, and 2.10.24 in the marathon, which he ran this year at Chicago, and he finished fifth, and that's actually, at the time of this recording, he is the fastest American of the year. He's actually just recently renewed his contract with Nike, and he's looking forward to a promising career in the future. So today, Luke and I are going to talk about what it's like running at the University of Oregon and what kind of resources they have access to. I know that's something that a lot of us have been curious about. How his debut at the New York City Marathon of 2:28 was not only the worst 2 hours and 28 minutes of his life, but it was enough to make him reconsider ever running again. And how good it felt at Chicago to come back and run a 2:10 after all that. You're really going to enjoy it, and let's just get on with it. Welcome to the Run to the Top podcast, Luke.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Excited to have you, and I'm sure many people are curious to hear about your story here, as this is quite an interesting one, and I know a lot of our listeners love hearing the behind the scenes of an elite runner. So first, let's start with your collegiate career, as I'm sure you kind of had a dream come true for most runners running for the University of Oregon. Can you kind of tell us a bit what that was like, and maybe, you know, did you have a lot of pressure on you because it was such a prestigious university, or what was your experience for it?
Yeah. So, I mean, in high school and growing up, I mean, I watched the movie Prefontaine, and kind of that's what I was familiar with. And it was almost like this glamorous thing. And, you know, it's just something that I wanted to do. And it was to try to excel at a high level there. And I went out on a visit, and I was hosted by Matthew Centrowitz and Chris Kwiatkowski, who I'm still very close with. And so, I mean, on the college visit, I don't think it could have been, you know, I competed against Centro and those guys, and Chris is just a great guy, and everybody on the team. And, you know, AJ Acosta was on the team at the time. Galen Rupp was on the team. So It was yeah, it was just all those guys on the team. There wasn't too much pressure for me to come in my freshman year and try to be you know, a performer, just because they had won nationals the year before in cross country. And I mean, that's what I was really brought me there, was what they had done in cross country. And so, I mean, it was kind of a dream come true being part of the team. And we won my freshman year as a team, and I was the fifth overall. But I think the winning as a team is something that will always stick with me. And so just through that is that it's still cool now, even as an alumni, being able to be involved, you know, just being able to be part of that community. And you know, where I'm still working with Andy Powell, who is the coach there, is it's cool just to kind of, yeah, still be connected with it and live in Eugene, which is a college town. So,
mm-hmm. So everyone kind of stays very connected. All the alumni are still, you're very much interact with each other and kind of support one another's like post-collegiate journeys.
Yeah, it's just kind of, it's different. I mean, I think University of Oregon and especially Eugene is, I mean, it's just probably like any other college town, but I mean, we have professional basketball with the Portland Trailblazers in the state of Oregon, but, and we have now have the Timbers in soccer, but we don't have a football team and a baseball team. And so it's kind of, you know, people around here, they follow Oregon Ducks football, and it's like a lot of people take pride in that. And I think because of that, that spills over to it's people write on the end of their emails. If you're talking to someone from Oregon, they write "Go Ducks," whether they were on the running team or not. And it's like, it's a cool, yeah, community type thing. So,
yeah. And then, so you said you didn't really feel too much pressure coming in, but was it a little bit intimidating for you having some of those, like you said, those big names on the team, or have you always been someone who could just kind of handle that?
No, absolutely. It was definitely like, I was just trying to soak everything up, you know, and, you know, the first experience I had with all of them was when we went to cross country camp in Sun River, which is about 3 hours east of here. And, you know, Galen was just coming back from the Olympics. Like Weeding had been at the Olympics, Andrew Weeding. And so.
Sorry about that, guys. We've actually lost the call right there. So I'm just. I've called Luke back, and hopefully we're going to be clear from now. So Luke, if you could just go back, you were just saying that Galen Rupp and Andrew Weeting had just come back from the Olympics, about your first experience with them.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely encouraging. You know, I mean, as an 18-year-old, I think I kind of felt like I had the world at my fingertips. I had the right training facilities. I had, if these guys could do it in that atmosphere, that I felt like I could, you know. And a lot of the goals were probably overly ambitious, and, you know, I fell on my face a few times during it, but I think it was just one of those things where everybody else was doing it and everybody else was excelling. So there was really no excuse to, you know, not excel. So. Mm-hmm.
Did it make it really easy to do, or, you know, the little things that we're told we should do because everyone around you is kind of doing them all and, you know, really putting running as a priority?
Yeah, I mean, that was the funny thing, is that when I was on the team, everybody seemed to have their special thing. And I'm sure it's like this on any team, and I've seen it running professionally. Everybody has a different routine, whether it's the icing, whether it's stretching, and just the whole routine of doing it. And so, you know, it wasn't that uniform. And so you had, you know, Matthew Centrowitz, who would do, you know, more core and that sort of stuff. And then you had some guys that liked, you know, doing more drills and stuff. And I guess it's just what works for them. So
did that kind of work well, or was there, I can imagine, I'm just thinking myself, like if I saw, you know, let's say Andrew Weeting doing something that I thought I wasn't doing, do you kind of like copy each other and like, oh, maybe you should try this? Or is it very much like, okay, I do this and you do this, whatever works for you?
I mean, especially when I first came to, you know, when I first came to Oregon, I was just copying everything those guys were doing. It worked for me. And I think I just wasn't experienced. I mean, running in high school, I only ran, you know, 40 to 50 miles a week. And I did all my runs at, you know, 520, 530 pace because I didn't know any better. You know, so this whole training program was different. And so, you know, if I hear one of the guys sleeps, you know, 13 hours a day, then I was going to go back to my dorm and I was going to go back to, like, I was going to try to sleep 13 hours and work. You know, that's just the way. And I just tried to soak everything up because I really looked up to what they had done in their careers.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. And were the coaches heavily involved, or was it very much like they were involved in the workout aspect and then the other part of it was kind of, you know, on your own?
We had some structure, but, you know, I think, like, we would all do the same drills and stuff to recover and to warm up. But the stretching is kind of, that was kind of, you just do that on your own because different stuff works for different people. And from that, some people will do more core after doing the drills and stuff than other people. And so I guess from there, it was just preference. You know, like Matthew Centritz would do more core than anybody. Maybe some people would do 50% of what he was doing or something like that. It's what worked for him, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners have always kind of wondered what this is like. Could you kind of run us through, you know, let's say a workout day while you were at University of Oregon, like what would that involve? Like all the little resources you get, you know, like do you get you get to talk to a nutritionist after your workout? Or could you kind of just give us a day in the life of a University of Oregon student, a collegiate athlete, I guess?
Yeah, so I think... you know, we get that a lot at the university. When I was at the university is, you know, all the resources, that the football players get. And I think some people see that and they see what the track guys get and, you know, whether it's Hayward Field. And I think that University of Oregon is very supportive of the athletic department. And so I personally don't like using a lot of the, I didn't like using a lot of the resources that we did have. Like I'm more simple. Like I'd rather just with the nutritionist, I would rather like maybe sit down at the beginning of the year, come up with a plan. And then, you know, you don't see, I would rather not see the nutritionist, you know, have to keep checking in and that sort of stuff. So, I mean, I guess the day when I was there, I mean, and it was preference. Some people would go to the nutritionist more, you know, and it was more if you were getting hurt but if everything works, then you keep what works, you know? And so that's kind of the mentality. If it's not broken, don't fix it. And mm-hmm. So I guess a normal day would be workout days that I'd wake up, you know, pretty early because of my classes. kind of funny thinking back that I had to wake up that early. And run usually, 5 miles to my dorm. And then go to classes, have breakfast and then kind of hang out, have coffee. And then we'd all meet up at 2 for our practice and, just have a team meeting and kind of the coach would go over things and what we were trying to accomplish in the workout and what group was doing what. And then we'd do, you know, pretty standard 3-mile warm up, do the workout, cool down, and then it was, you know, we'd do the like some of this stuff on our own, the form drills and that sort of stuff and the stretching. And then I, especially when I was at Oregon, I was just trying to get as much sleep as I could, because I thought that was what I needed to do, because I saw everybody that was competing well, that was kind of the thing, is so that my freshman year, I'd actually go eat dinner, work on homework and be in bed by like 7 o'clock. And wow. I know it sounds crazy now when I think about it, but like, you know, that's just what I thought you had to do.
So. Yeah. And it probably helped you as well, right? Getting that much sleep? Or do you think you had too much?
No, I think it was great. And, you know, now I have a daughter and I think I've in the last 4 months, I've definitely slept less and less. And I think that's one thing when talking to, you know, Andy Powell about my training and stuff, is it's like, it's the simple things and it's eating right, sleeping. And there's no secret formula that no one knows about. If it was that big of a secret, it wouldn't be a secret anymore. So
yeah, absolutely. Great advice there. And so then what about when you graduated college? Did you think because you'd had this successful university career, you'd seen other people go on to run at the Olympics, like how did you see your life unfolding in your mind when you left?
Yeah, it was tough. You know, it's humbling because at University of Oregon, you get treated so well. And yeah, like you were saying, you have trainers and even though I didn't use them, a lot of the trainers and the nutritionists, like, you know that you have that. And it's almost like a security blanket, and you really don't know what you have until you've gone and left. And I'm sure it's like that at any university. And you're on your own. You don't have, you know, people to meet with, and you don't have the structure of training. And so when I first graduated, I stuck around in Eugene for, you know, half a year, 6 months. And it was, you know, some days I'd wake up at 12 o'clock and go train and I'd stay up later because I didn't have the structure of practice. So I think that was the biggest adjustment for me. So.
Mm-hmm. And then what about, tell us about that first marathon. Like, you know, I know my first marathon was kind of a similar experience. Like you know, you run so well at the longer distances and, you know, you think, oh, I'm going to be a natural at the marathon. And you keep, you know, you think, oh, as I move up, I'm going to keep getting stronger. But, you know, your first marathon, you really struggled. So do you want to kind of tell us about like what happened there and, you know, what factors kind of went into that?
Yeah, I think I think that you touched on that is that, you know, people tell you you're going to be a natural at it. And in college, you know, I went a different route and I had University of Oregon allowing me to do that in that, you know, running the Houston half marathon my senior year, which is very unconventional.
Yeah.
And so from after that, so that would have been 2012, and it was the day before the Olympic trials. And so I just had this thought in my head where, you know, it's probably over my head, but it was like, man, after I ran that time, I was like, man, like maybe I should have ran the Olympic trials, like in the marathon, like maybe, like that would have been a good shot, you know? And, yeah, it didn't make sense at all. But I guess from that is that people kept telling me like, yeah, you don't have the closing speed. So on the track. So, but you're strong. So you'll be good in the marathon. And so leading up to New York, I just had this anxiety and, you know, I wasn't sleeping the way I should have been. I just was so nervous. And, you know, I was thinking, well, what if this happens? You know, what if this happens? And people say you have to respect the distance. And I think I was scared of the distance. And mm-hmm. by the end of it, when it was time to toe the line, you know, it's just I didn't have the balance in my life where I could think about other stuff than running. And when I was thinking about running, it was thinking, man, this is going to be dreadful. Like, at some point, I'm going to hit the wall. And, you know, there's no going back after that. So,
yeah.
And then in the race, it was one of those things. I thought, oh, well, it's windy. And the way New York is the first mile is uphill. So it's usually slow anyways. And so everybody was together for the first mile, but you know, you see 5:20 and you're like, man, I feel like we're running 4:30 pace right now. And I just never was able to warm up. So
do you think you kind of freaked yourself out, or do you think it was a case of you know, you were never going to be able to run fast on that particular day with the weather?
No, I think it was me. I think I had psyched myself out so much, was scared of the distance. And I mean, even if it would have been perfect weather in, you know, Chicago, even if it would have been perfect weather in Chicago and, you know, easier course, I think it would have been the same result. Is that it was, you know, during that race, I went from being like, all right, well, just run under, you know, 2:20. And then people kept passing me and it was like, all right, just finish. And then by the end, I was like, you better finish because it's the last time you're ever going to run again. Like, I don't ever want to run a marathon again, and I don't want to look back at my career and say, well, like, I didn't finish the one that I did, and so I need to run it again. So, I mean, this is the longest 2 hours and 28 minutes of my life, and I know it sounds dramatic because it's something I chose to do, and, you know, there's people in a lot worse circumstances, and so, you know, it just was almost like a mental breakdown that just unraveled, and I just needed to get done with it, so.
Yeah, no, and I think people, you know, although, like you said, you feel like you're being dramatic, I don't think you are. I mean, I think most people listening can see that, you know, you came out of college and you dedicated your life to this. You know, you that's the problem I personally feel with, you know, being a full-time athlete, and that's why I choose not to do it myself, is because I don't think I'd be able to hold that balance right there with, you know, having balance, but at the same time, all you have to think about is running. So I think a lot of people will appreciate that, yes, you know, that was a long, like a struggle for you, but you'd put your heart and soul into it. And everyone who's run a marathon knows how much time and dedication that takes. So I'm sure people can appreciate that and see that, you know, how devastating that must have been. And then what happened after the race? Like, did you finish thinking, you know, agreeing with that still, that's it? Or was it kind of like a little seed in the back of your mind, like, someday I'm going to redeem myself?
No, it was, you know, it was, I was, during the race, I came to peace with it. And I was, but, you know, right when I crossed the finish line, I saw Mary Wittenberg, who was the elite director, or the whole marathon director at that time. And so, and she was very nice, and, you know, she looked, you know, like she was not upset with me. It was more like she felt for me, and you know, she said, hey, you know, like, I wish this would have gone better for you, you know. And you know, I don't think a lot of other race directors would do that, you know, especially when you get paid an appearance fee to come out, and, you know, they kind of vouched for you and all of that. And so I think New York Roadrunners are great with doing that. And so, yeah, it was her telling me, like, yeah, I wish it would have gone better. And, you know, it was me seeing my wife, and, like, I didn't want to be anywhere around it, jumping in a cab, getting back, to the hotel room. And it was, you know, I told her, and I told my parents, and I was like, yeah, I think I'm done doing this, and I'm going to have to find something else, I guess. And because I've always felt like running is what I wanted to do. At that point, though, my parents were saying, okay, well, what's the next step then? Like, do you want to be a coach? I didn't want anything to do with the running at all. I didn't want to be a coach. And so we went to South Africa the day after to visit my wife's family. And, you know, I put on 23 pounds and just had no desire to, you know, usually a lot of runners, when we take breaks, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to the podcast know, is that, you know, you kind of have your thing that you can't eat during, like, chocolate or something when you're training. And so when you take your week off after a race, like, you eat everything you can that you weren't able to eat. And so it was like that. But I knew I was never going to run again. And it was a month of doing that. And so I came back from South Africa. And at that point, we moved from Portland to Eugene for my wife's job, who's a tennis pro at the Eugene Swim and Tennis down here. And so, you know, I think it was tough for me because I was just sitting around. And that would have been after a month. And then another month went by, and I still had no desire to run. And, you know, I was fortunate that my wife, if I said, hey, like, when we bought a house, I was like, when we were looking at houses, I was like, hey, I think I can be a realtor. And she's like, no, like, you know, you need to do something that you're, like, excited about for more than one day. Mm-hmm. And then when we got work done in the house, I was like, well, I think I could be a contractor. It was the same thing. And, you know, then it was a card dealer, and, like, it was just, I was trying to find my place, you know, and it's just, I never found it, you know, looking for 2 months, and I was fortunate to have Andy Powell sit down with me, and who's at the University of Oregon, and he just was like, hey, you know, if you want to come by, you come by, like, and run with the guys, or even just come by, you know, and be around the guys, like, I think it'd be healthy, not just for running, but so that you can get out of the house. And so I started coming by, and I was like, all right, well, do you need help timing workouts? And it's kind of like, no, like, you should run with the guys. And I was like, I told you I'm not going to run, you know? So it was just slowly him helping me out and my wife helping me out, like, convinced me this is what, like, what I love doing and I don't have to give it up.
Mm-hmm. So was it during that time, was it, you know, during those 2 months, did you have even like a moment where you wanted to run, or was it completely like, I am done with this, I don't want to look at it, I don't want to know anything, or was it like in and out?
No, I mean, there was moments where I try to convince myself, like, all right, yeah, I can, like, I'm able to do it. And I'm, you know, if you ask a lot of the guys on the team, you know, Matthew Centuris, who was down here in the fall, and he was, and I talked with him, I talked with Parker Stinson, who was, I was on the team with, and I told him, like, I would have these glimpses of hope, like, I'm like, all right, maybe I can do it. And it would be not, I wouldn't even get to the point of trying on my, putting on my shoes to go run. It would be to the point where it's like, I'll tell them, I don't know if my legs, my muscles are going to respond the same way, because I think in New York, I just felt like I wasn't running on my own legs. You know, I felt like my hamstrings weren't firing correctly. And so I didn't know if I was ever going to be able to, like, run at the same way. And I know it sounds stupid, but if I watch the guys doing a workout and let's say they're running 440 per mile, in the back of my head, I was like, I, no matter how much training I do, I don't know if I'll be able to do that again, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. No, I actually do understand you. I felt the same way for a long time after my first marathon, where it kind of went the similar way to yours. And I kept saying to my coach that I felt like something snapped inside of me, and I couldn't explain it to anyone, but I was like, I don't ever think I can push myself again, because I pushed myself too far that day. And I definitely can see that. And I'm sure the listeners, a lot of them can, you know, see glimpses of that. And then how long was it before it slowly started? Was it that it built up over time you started to get back into it, or was it just one day you woke up and kind of missed it?
Yeah, no. So I guess the way it went is that I was going down to practice for, so that was at, so 2 months, like, completely away from it. And then, you know, I started going down to practice and just interacting with the guys and, just talking with them and stuff. And I wasn't running at the time, and everybody just thought it was crazy. And I was like, yeah, I'm done with it, you know? And so, from there it was, you know, trying to run with the guys. And, you know, even during those runs, like, it's just, I think running is such a mental thing, is that if you tell yourself enough that, like, that your legs aren't firing or something, they're probably not going to fire. If you tell yourself you don't feel good, you're not going to feel good. And I mean, I would run, you know, 20 minutes with the guys, and I couldn't run under 8 minute pace, because I was 8 minute per mile pace, because I told myself that and I convinced myself that. So, it was about a month of trying to get into shape to even do a proper workout. So that would be 3 months after New York. And then I started doing kilometer repeats, and, you know, I would struggle to try to break 320 per kilometer, which should have been an easy task at that point.
Yeah. Well, okay. And it just slowly started to come back to you over time, like the fitness, and as you got back with the fitness, the mental side kept coming back with it.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing was that Coach Powell did a great job with, like, keeping me excited. And I got to a point in the training where I was like, where I was happy with where I was. And at that point, I wasn't even thinking about racing. You know, it was, I'm happy with where I'm at. I'll just keep doing this. And if I don't race again, and it's like I'm still feel like I'm living a healthy lifestyle, and looking back, you know, my wife was the one working at that time, so I felt bad. It was almost to the point then where it was like, well, maybe I can run and get another job, and that's how we pay the bills, you know.
Mm-hmm. And then
he kind of helped me get back into racing and just find smaller road races. And I think it's the stuff outside, is the story of, you know, it's, you can win if you win New York or you win Chicago, it would make it more special if you had a, you know, if you had a connection with it, you know. And so I raced the 10K at the Vancouver Sun Run in, that must have been April of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a race that my in-laws had done for the last 7 years, because they live in BC, British Columbia. And I was able to walk away with a win there, which is, I'll always look at that as, yeah, it's not one of the huge meets with elite, in like a prestigious elite group, but that's probably when everything started clicking. That will always be like a special moment to be able to share that with, you know, my wife's parents, and them walking it, and my wife walking it, she's pregnant at the time, is that will always be like a big turning point, and that's what was getting me excited about it again. So.
Mm-hmm. I think that's important as well, that, you know, it wasn't necessarily a big, you know, big race where there was, you know, a stacked field. It was just, you found it on your own. It wasn't, you know, you forced it and it is going to have to be this race or have to be that race. You just kind of found it on your own. And do you think if it hadn't have been for Andy and your wife, do you think you would have gone back to running, or do you think it would have taken longer, or would you have even wanted to do it again?
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I think that they were the big components, and the guys around Eugene, you know, that with Parker Stinson and Matthew Centrowitz, and, you know, the list goes on, with the guys that were telling me it was crazy and stuff. But I mean, truthfully, I don't think it didn't seem worth it to me if I was going to sacrifice everything. And, you know, especially where my wife gave birth in July. And so I just felt like maybe the running thing was a pipe dream, and, you know, that I had this hobby that I wasn't getting paid for, and that it just didn't make sense. You know, I felt selfish, and so if I wouldn't have had them being supportive, there was plenty of times that my wife could have been like, yeah, if you want to get a job, like, do it, you know. But, you know, she gave me the opportunity to keep running until something clicked.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. And that's fantastic that you have such a, you know, two people, well, more than two people, that really care about you, and they knew deep down that it was going to make you happy, but didn't force you to it, just let you kind of come to that conclusion on your own. So would you say, looking back now, that you're kind of glad it happened the way it did, because it kind of, you know, helped you discover who you are and helped you become the person you are?
Yeah, I just think, you know, where we were talking about the different stuff at the University of Oregon, and, you know, you do everything. I think I was very different there, as a lot of people are in college, not only in athletics, but in college period, is, you got to do what you have to do. You know, you're not, like, I wasn't married at the time, and it was all about running, and everything what revolved around that. And, you know, I think if I would have ran all right in New York and been comfortable with it, I think that I would have kept, you know, living a life of, well, I have to have this regimen, I got to sacrifice all this stuff to run well, And I don't know, I just look back, and maybe that was one of the big reasons why I didn't want to run anymore, is that I didn't think it was worth sacrificing everything, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to balance everything the way I feel like I'm able to now. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of like it was you were kind of like a time bomb, and then that New York was just, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back. And, you know, if it hadn't have been New York, it would have been the next bad race you would have had. Or
Think it was, you know, I think that it had to be for me to like really take a step back and see that it's not, you know, that, you know, if you take a step back as an elite runner, and it's hard to do, is, and you look, it's easy to look at other competitors and say, okay, well, this guy's doing this workout, this guy's doing this workout. But if you take a step out of it, and I think during that 2 months, I was able to do that and see that a lot of the tough guys, a lot of the Kenyans, they have kids, they have other balance, you know, and it's family time and all that sort of stuff. And they're able to compete at a high level. And, you know, they're probably able to compete at a higher level that they do have balance.
So. Yeah. So what would you like to say to anyone listening about balance and about how, you know, if they can kind of feel themselves getting to the point where running is becoming their life, and, you know, say they get some kind of twinge that means they can't run for a day, and then it means they spend the rest of the day like crying, or like, if, you know, someone listening right now is kind of seeing themselves in what you're saying and kind of feels like they might be getting a bit too obsessed with it, what would you like to say based on the lessons you've learned since graduating and since that race?
Yeah, I think a lot of, as a runner, you identify, you know, whenever I would get introduced by my parents growing up, it was, yeah, he runs track, he's a runner. And when I, that's how I identified myself when I was in college. Is that hung out with the student athletes, and like everybody in the student athlete group knew what sport everybody did, and that's how you identified what, you know, what you were as a person. And now it's, you know, I'm a husband first, dad first, you know, son, friend. And, you know, the running is, at the end of the day, you know, running is a small thing, and it's something that, it's great. It's not the competition part. I shouldn't say running a small thing. The competition part and trying to compete at the highest level, you know, you look back, if I look back at however many years from now, as long as I was happy with my career, it doesn't matter if I won some big race. As long as it's like the Vancouver Sun Run thing, is it's like I was able to have that special moment with family, and that was bigger than, you know, winning the race. And so I think it's more just how you identify, and you see things different. Like, before, if I was to do something, you know, I'd be like, well, I need to do this to get out of, to help me recover for running. Whereas now it's having the balance, and then the running comes second. So.
Mm-hmm. Have you kind of seen with, I'm not sure if you had a boy or a girl as a child.
Yeah, I had a girl.
A little girl. Have you seen through her that she, you know, how simple babies live their life? Like, it's just eating, you know, it's just being in the moment. Whereas did it kind of help you put a reality on things of what really matter?
Yeah, I think that it's just basic. Yeah, you say eating, sleeping, but it doesn't take much to make, you know, it doesn't take much to make a baby happy, you know, and it's the simple things. And so it's just crazy. And I like, not to get philosophical and stuff, but it's like, what age do you get to where things start getting gradually more, it's harder to be happy. You know, there's like an excuse for not being happy instead of like just being in the moment and being able just to smile. And, you know, when do you get to the point where whatever made you smile like doesn't do it anymore? And that's how I felt with the running, is that, you know, there's always something. If I won a race, I would still scrutinize myself and be like, well, I didn't run fast enough. So it was never good enough, you know? Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I think a lot of people will understand that, especially the never happy part. So then how great did it feel at Chicago? You know, you ran 2:10, the fastest American time this year, finished fifth. How did that feel knowing that it all came together after all those struggles you went through?
Yeah, it's just crazy. You know, you know, I called Carrie Pinkowski, the meet director,
yep,
3 weeks before. And, you know, I got in touch with him about, you know, running the race. And, you know, he's the one that gave me the chance. And, look, you know, I joke around with him as it's like, if someone called me three weeks before a marathon, I would be like, yeah, you can get lost. Like, that doesn't make sense. You're going to run this race. It's in 3 weeks. But, you know, I think I always wanted Chicago Marathon to be like a special race to me, mm-hmm, because my parents are from Decatur, Illinois, and Sterling, Illinois. And so all of my cousins live in Chicago area by Wrigley Field, and they're part of that community. And so I think having that go well for me was big, because I was able to share it with my family and them be there and get to see it and be part of it. So
yeah, absolutely. And I did actually interview Kerry, and he was a great guest. And you know, I talked in the interview about how fantastic of a person he is. Actually, I guess that's a good time to mention the show notes, which are at runnersconnect.net/RC86. And I will put a link to Kerry's interview there. But so then you said about 3 weeks to go. Had you been training for the marathon and it was like, maybe, you know, if I feel good, then I'll do it? Or was it just a spur of the moment decision?
So, yeah, I was training. I guess the big focus for this year was even when I started training from day one, you know, when I started running again, was that everything needed to be gearing towards the Olympic trials. And I guess that's what kind of, you know, sitting down with my wife, mm-hmm, and talking with her, is it was like, she just said, hey, if you always wanted to try to make an Olympic team, you know, wait until after the trials, give it everything you have. And then after the trials, make the assessment, you know? And so, so that from there, I was doing shorter races and I had planned on running. I ran New Haven September 7th, and then I actually had contacted the 10-mile championships that were October 4th, and I had everything but the ticket lined up to go out there. And so I was planning on doing shorter races, and then kind of doing a marathon build-up for the Olympic trials. But I don't know, just kind of 3 weeks before, just like I felt excited about it, and I just didn't know if I had enough time when I started training to be ready by Chicago, but I felt ready. So I just kind of reached out to Carrie and Carrie Pinkowski and kind of saw where he was at, and it made sense. So
yeah, and it obviously paid off big time for you. So I'm guessing Olympic team is kind of the goal now, but how are you planning on going into the trials? Is it the same kind of strategy you used for Chicago, or what things are you kind of changing?
Yeah, so I mean, it's basically the same exact, will be the same exact build up for me, is that, I don't know, I think that a lot of people, they look at marathon training, and me included, is that you need to do a lot of longer stuff, and people kind of get away from doing the speed aspect of in training. And so if I was able to race and feel the way I did in the race and feel engaged in the training, you know, doing less mileage and doing more speed stuff, you know, I don't think that I need to do anything different. You know, probably I need to keep excelling, like trying to get faster in the workouts and stuff, but the same thing, if it's not broken, I'm not going to try to fix it. So.
Yeah, and you're still working with Andy?
Yeah, so I have a good relationship with Andy. You know, he's a good friend, and, you know, where he coaches at the university, you know, that's like, I don't want to interfere with that. And, you know, he helps me out in any way he can. And so it's kind of a different dynamic, but I think it works for both of us.
So. Mm-hmm. No, that's great. And then, so anyone wanting to kind of stay in touch with you or follow along with you as you continue training and throughout your career, what would be the best way for them to follow you?
Yeah, so I'm not, with like the social media and stuff, I probably don't do as good of a job as I should. And my wife is, you know, she's a advertising and graphic design double major. So she's been harping on me about it. So, yeah, Twitter, I do Twitter and Instagram, and I'll try to get better at it. But yeah, I guess it's just Lupus Schedula for both of those. So
that can be your challenge as of now, before this gets released. You want to have some posts up. So hopefully when you guys are listening to this, he's been keeping really up to date, and you all know what he's been up to because he's been keeping up to date with it. So this is your challenge now. Okay, Luke, well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I'm impressed that you've managed to keep your little girl quiet, or maybe she's not in the house right now, while we've talked. And I really appreciate you giving your insight and kind of sharing your story. I think it's good for people to hear that, you know, elite runners, it's not all, you know, exactly how you imagine. And often we have, you know, this thought about, in our hearts, we know that life never goes as planned, but we kind of almost expect it to anyway. So it's great to hear that, you know, you went through a struggle, but you've come out the other side, and it's worth the perseverance. So thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, wasn't that interesting? I think most of us have allowed our running life to swing out of balance and allow it to define us at some point. But it just goes to show that these things happen for a reason. And even the best runners in the world need to have other things in their life outside of their running. Make sure next week you tune into Katie Foster, who's lost over 125 pounds through running. She shares her running journey, and you're going to love it. So it's this time of year, I want to thank you again for taking the time to tune in. This is the time when we really get to spend time with our loved ones, and we appreciate what we have in our lives. So this not only makes me thankful to be able to spend time with the guests that come on the show, but also with you. I love hearing from you, and I would appreciate it if your Christmas present, if you celebrate it, to me could be to give a review on iTunes. I would really be grateful for that. But even if not, thank you so much for taking the time to tune in if this is your first or your 50th episode. I really, really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope you enjoy it too. So until next week, hope you have an absolutely wonderful week.